This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an extended update on some recent court decisions and political developments, including the Mumia Abu-Jamal decision from the Third Circuit, exposure of Professor John Yu's most recent torture memo, and an indecency law in Indiana.
Well, we were disappointed by the Mumia decision. Heidi will be here to tell you more about that. She knows Mumia. We got another barbaric memo from John Yu, formerly at the Justice Department, now a professor at one of our prestigious universities. They should have never hired him, and they should fire him today. And then every once in a while in this country, the Puritans rear their ugly head. This time they're trying to ban children from reading books with indecent titles, whatever that means. I guess Lady Chatterley's Lover, To Have and Have Not? I'm not sure. Anyway, I think it'll be struck down.
We'll also hear excerpts from an event at the New York Public Library, chaired by our own Michael Ratner, titled An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life.
If you want to be moved to tears, listen to this event. A 19-year-old man, the U.S. knew he was innocent after 6 months, kept in Guantanamo and tortured relentlessly for 5 years.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
On March 27th, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia made a ruling in the case of Mumia. We want to discuss that today, particularly with our host Heidi, who has actually visited Mumia on occasion and has been following closely the legal ramifications of the various lawsuits brought on Mumia's behalf. Heidi?
Well, it's been a year since the oral arguments in this case, and we've been waiting anxiously for a decision, which came, as you said, on March 27th. Now, it was a mixed decision. We had been really hoping that the judges would find that racial discrimination had permeated this trial, as many of us believe it did, given the history of police corruption and racial animosity in Philadelphia in the 80s. But two of the judges found that it did not. And what they specifically found was that the prosecution was not motivated by racial discrimination when it struck blacks from the panel of prospective jurors.
Right. One of the many issues in the case was a jury issue. And there's a ruling from the Supreme Court called the Batson case, which essentially says prosecutors cannot strike people from a jury panel based on race. And the claim here by Mumia and his lawyers was that, in fact, that's what happened. Now, what year was that when Mumia was convicted?
1982.
So
it was before Batson.
So it's before Batson, but they applied Batson rules to this case. And so what happened in that? There were three judges on this.
Yeah.
It was 2-1 on that issue, as I recall.
It was, right? And there was a very long dissent in this. The whole decision was 118 pages, and there was a 40-page dissent by Justice Thomas Ambrose, who questioned why the court chose this case to essentially announce a new procedural requirement. And that requirement was that Mumia had to have asserted early on in the trial that there was racial discrimination. That was under the case, the Supreme Court case Swain, where you have to say there was a case of discrimination and you have to make a clear record of that.
And that was before Batson.
Pre-Batson.
Right.
And essentially Batson overruled Swain. Mm-hmm. What Justice Ambrose said that he would have ordered a new hearing and required the prosecution to explain its challenges of black jury panelists, quote, It is merely to take the next step in deciding whether race was impermissibly considered during jury selection in this case. And one of the arguments that lead attorney Robert Bryan, well, he closed with in his statement, and I think this is so true, is that we have evidence and Supreme Court cases from the early 80s and before the 80s finding that many of these cases, death penalty cases, had racial discrimination in them. And after Mumia's cases, there's a whole body of work. Are we to believe one case of a former Black Panther journalist who was outspoken against the police department corruption in Philadelphia? Are we to believe that we stopped having racial discrimination? Further, on the record is the fact that Judge Szabo, the judge who presided over both the guilt and the penalty phase of this case, was overheard to say in chambers, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger." And knowing all of that, it seems really an anomaly that this case would not have racial
What's remarkable is here you have a 2-1 decision saying they can't even go to the next step, that Mumia's lawyers can't even go to the next step of forcing the prosecutor to say, why did you strike all these blacks from the jury panel?
Yeah, it looks like a cover-up.
What's the next step on
What are the other points?
Well, there was one other point, and this is important. It's called the Mills claim, and it has to do with the form that the jurors were given in what are always very complicated penalty phases where they decide whether the defendant is going to get guilt or death. And these phases are notorious around the country for being very confusing because they require the jurors to do a balancing act between mitigating circumstances. Those would be good things to consider, accomplishments of the defendant. Mumia was an award-winning journalist, for one thing, had worked on behalf of his community. Balancing with aggregating factors. One of those would be that killing a police officer is, under statutory law, always considered an aggravator. Now, jurors, they're allowed to find mitigating circumstances, and they're supposed to list aggravators. In this case, the form was very confusing and made the jurors feel they had to be unanimous on the mitigators, which is not the law. They did not have to be unanimous.
They could have recommended mitigation even if 7 out of the 12 jurors wanted it.
Precisely. So the court in this appeal ruled that the death penalty cannot be reinstated unless a new penalty hearing is held within 180 days. Essentially, it means that Mumia will not get life. If there is no new penalty hearing, he will have life in prison.
Right. If they don't go ahead and give a little trial on whether he should get the death penalty, then he'll be in prison for the rest of his life.
Exactly.
According to the
Exactly.
judge.
Now, what a lot of people don't remember is that several years ago, his death sentence was actually removed under Justice Yon. So he's been technically now serving life, even though he remains literally on death row. But what is going to happen now is that the defense, headed by Robert Bryan and Judith Ritter, are filing a request to have the entire Third Circuit rehear this.
Entire panel.
The entire panel, rather than just the 3 judges.
Which is about 9 or 12 or 13
exactly.
or 14 judges. Everybody.
Right.
And I don't know how the Third Circuit's practice is, how often they would grant that kind of request. You know, what was also interesting to me, I don't know whether if they grant it, obviously it's a big deal, because actually after reading the jury form on the question of mitigating circumstances and this issue that came up about whether you had to be unanimous to find the mitigating circumstance, I read it in the opinion, and there's no way that wasn't going to be reversed. I mean, the form was clear to me. It seemed clear to me, if I were a juror reading that it would require unanimity to find the mitigating circumstance. And so I think that there's no risk here of the prosecutor, they'll probably appeal too on that, to an on-bank panel, but there's not much risk. That form really should have been thrown out.
Right.
So Mumia, at least on that issue, I think will go forward, and either they'll give him a new hearing or life in prison. On the underlying bigger issue for Mumia, which is the new trial issue that could come as a result of a bad jury selection, of a racist jury selection, that, of course, is a big issue, and whether they'll take it on-bank, I don't know.
Yeah, it could go either way. And I think one of the things that's worth mentioning is that I visited Mumia, the last time was about a year ago, but he jokingly refers to what's called the Mumia rule, which means that there are actually different laws in place for him. I think this Batson issue, to me, is one such issue because there was a recent Supreme Court decision on Batson that actually turned out favorably on behalf of the defendant. It wasn't precisely the same set of facts that Mumia had, but it gave us a glimmer of hope the court might look favorably.
No, I think the Supreme Court on these issues has been pretty interesting in the last few years. You have the case that you just referred to, and then a case that happened a couple years ago called the Miller L case, which was also a racially discriminatory picked jury, and they reversed the Miller L conviction. So the Supreme Court seems, for whatever inexplicable reason to me, very sensitive on these racial selection issues.
To people who know Philadelphia and who are familiar with the facts of Mumia's case, really how corrupt the Philadelphia Police Department was from the inception of his case. There was a 1993 police corruption scandal in which 300 convictions were thrown out by the court as being improper because of police misconduct. And the Philadelphia District Attorney revealed that juries had routinely been selected with an eye toward excluding blacks. Also, there were numerous brutality suits and even an FBI probe into the department that resulted in the conviction of 30 police officers for corruption, which greatly damaged that city's police department's image. And as listeners may remember, in 1985, police bombed the MOVE organization's West Philly residence and two city blocks, which also resulted in federal investigations into police brutality and corruption. And then in 1979, just a few years before Mumia was arrested, the United States Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against former police commissioner and later Mayor Frank Rizzo for police brutality, citing nearly 300 fatal police shootings of civilians in just a three-year period.
I remember those days. A good friend of ours, Judith Chomsky and Holly McGuigan, David Rudofsky, who I sat next to in law school, all guild members, were practicing in Philadelphia in those years, and we used to hear about it. Philadelphia was, you know, like Chicago. It was terrible. Heidi, there's a new indecency law in Indiana that got a bookstore busted. Tell me the details.
This is yet another crackdown on First Amendment issues that we've been seeing since 9/11, targeting bookstores, libraries, and the like. In mid-March, the Indiana legislature passed a measure making it a misdemeanor for failure of a bookseller to register titles, which is considered, quote, deleterious to minors. Now, how's that for a vague definition?
I read a lot of those books when I was a minor.
Didn't we all? Lady Chatterley's Lover?
I did a book report on Lady Chatterley's Lover for my junior year in high school.
You'd be in trouble now for that. Under the law, a bookseller has to pay a $250 registration fee and is mandated to give a detailed description of the book. And it can include not only novels, but also school texts, such as ones that deal with health and sexuality. So if he or she has a textbook, you know, a science textbook, and it talks about the reproductive system, I would imagine under this law that is considered deleterious to minors. History and science books could probably also come under government scrutiny. I think it's also important to note that the FCC is handing out what they're calling public indecency penalties to major television networks. You know, ABC is facing a $1.43 million penalty for having exposed a woman's bare back in the shower on NYPD Blue. I didn't know that was not allowed on TV.
I didn't either.
We can laugh about this, but it's actually really serious infringement of the First Amendment.
Well, did they bust this bookseller in Indiana?
That law is going to go down so fast that we're not going to even know what hit us.
HB 1042, as it's called, was signed by Indiana Governor Mitch Daniel and goes into effect in July. But you're right, there will be protests. Groups like the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression are organizing to compel the governor to veto it. But look, these kinds of laws come up. I think it's indicative of the climate that we're in. It's important for us to talk about them because people need to know this kind of thing can come up and sometimes without public protest slip through. Another issue we wanted to mention was the fence that Michael Chertoff wants us to build in several states and to essentially ignore a set of laws such as environmental protection laws and other laws that have been passed. Michael, what's this about?
Well, they're building a 700-mile-long fence that goes Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California to keep out the Mexicans. This fence would violate some 30 laws that Congress has already passed. For example, laws with respect to the environment, like protecting certain birds, including the eagle, laws with respect to preserving grave sites of Native Americans. A whole number of laws are being violated, and Chertoff was the beneficiary in 2005 of the U.S. Congress saying, go ahead, ignore the laws that we've passed. We give you permission to ignore the laws that we've passed. This is violative of checks and balances. We elect Congress. Congress passes the laws. The executive is supposed to faithfully enforce those laws. And instead, Congress is laying down.
You know, they're like building some 3,000-mile fence along the Mexican border, which they're never going to really build. They've already admitted that. It's huge boondoggle for, like, companies that want to do, like, sort of an electronic part of the fence with satellites in the air and all kinds of stuff, you know, to keep Mexicans supposedly out of the United States. But of course, it's not going to do that, because as long as there's an economic necessity for people to get jobs, work, and support their families, they're going to come to the places they can do that. That apart from the fact there's probably another 20,000 miles of borders sitting around the United States. So it's all just a big boondoggle. And then on top of that, Michael, as you pointed out, they give this authority to, you know, to some Chertoff Homeland Security to basically bypass any single law he wants to, which I agree with you. From a point of view of the whole concept of checks and balances, a so-called tripartite government, Congress has a role, president has a role, courts have a role. I don't think it's ever going to fly. I would really be shocked. But I've been shocked by a lot in the last number of years.
No, you know, more broadly speaking, what we've been talking about for years on this program is the consolidation of power in the executive. And it's like the old Roman Republic going to Imperial Rome. And this is just another example of how this country is transmogrified by Bushy and the rest of them.
On this show, we've oftentimes discussed torture, Guantanamo, torture, Bagram, torture, United States. But particularly, we focused on use of dogs in Guantanamo and unmuzzled dogs toward inmates. And I consider that essentially a form of torture, to let an unmuzzled dog go up to a human being and bark as if the person is going to be bitten. And our own Heidi Boghossian had a recent experience in New York that is chilling and that makes you understand that dogs are not just something that are used in Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib.
The other week, I was rushing in the Union Square subway, which New Yorkers will know is a very busy subway station. And I came down the stairs and saw about six police officers. One was undercover, and one was a canine unit officer. So he had a German Shepherd with him. And they were surrounding an African-American man who looked to be in about his 30s, who was standing up against the wall, surrounded by the officers. At one, the undercover was yelling obscenities at the man, saying that he, bleep, bleep, told him he had identified himself as an officer. And then the dog was posed about 2 feet in front of the man, who was very subdued and quiet. And the dog was barking on high alert, literally 2 feet from the man's face, and barking repeatedly. It seemed to be at the urging of the canine unit officer who was holding him. So I stood there and watched, literally transfixed in horror, in this busy setting with, you know, hundreds of people walking by, and taking about, I'd say, 3 or 4 minutes of allowing the dog to bark in the face of this man who was doing nothing but was being restrained by officers. So I followed them as they moved through the turnstiles to take the gentleman into what is a subunit for, I guess, the transit police in the station. And I watched through the windows as they sat him down in the corner, again surrounded by five officers, and placed the canine unit again 2 feet in front of him and allowed the dog to bark really savagely, baring its teeth as though on high alert, as though if the police officer were to let him go, he was going to lunge at the gentleman and attack him.
Incredible brutality. I mean, torture, you know, no reason at all. Once, the extent you ever have to use a dog to apprehend somebody, which I'm not sure you ever do, but if you ever had to, once you have a person in custody with five cops standing around, what are you doing except torturing that human being? What are you doing?
Well, they've ratcheted up, you know, the New York City police got all this federal money after 9/11, part of which they used for dogs. So now you see dogs in Grand Central Station. You see them at Union Square. You don't need a dog in Grand Central Station. What do you need it for? Only to torture and intimidate people like this. Heidi, I'm glad that you're going to make a complaint about this. I'm going to file
a complaint with the Civilian Complaint Review Board, and then I'm going to write a few letters just to let people know that some of us are watching and witnessing torture.
And I'd be interested if any of our listeners have had any experiences like that. Obviously, there's a lot of brutality in this city, but particularly around dogs, because it is really an outrage.
Heidi, congratulations to the National Lawyers Guild for jumping on this new John Yoo story, another torture memo that he authored, an 81-page torture memo that he authored, I think in 2003, finally saw the light of day. And the National Lawyers Guild wrote an excellent press release on this. I wanted you to talk about that, please.
Well, we've talked about Professor John Yoo, who was at Bolt Hall, one of the really top law schools in the country. He authored a memo saying that the Department of Justice would construe U.S. criminal laws not to apply to the president's detention and interrogation of enemy combatants.
That's when he worked for the Department of Justice.
Exactly.
He then got the promotion as professor.
And what he says is that federal statutes against torture, assault, and maiming and stalking don't apply to the military in the conduct of war. Just to give an example, the federal maiming statute makes it a crime for someone, quote, with the intent to torture, maim, or disfigure, to cut, bite, or slit the nose, ear, or lip, or cut out or disable the tongue, pull out or destroy an eye, cut off or disable a limb, or any member of another person. And it also forbids individuals from throwing or pouring on another person any scalding water, corrosive acid, caustic substance with a similar intent. So what you has done, and mind you, this is, you know, professors at Bolt are considered the top legal minds of the country. John Yoo has narrowed, essentially, the definition of torture so that an interrogator must kill the person or cause organ failure or permanent loss of significant body functions in order for it to rise to the level of torture, a definition that clearly contravenes that in the Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty the U.S. has ratified and thus is part of our law. The Guild issued a release condemning this and calling for a Bolt Hall to dismiss John Yoo from its faculty. And what we also did was then email the press release to every single law professor at Bolt Hall. And we've called on our student chapter to conduct protests. But to me and to the Guild, this is really an outrage that someone who is the architect of a memo with these assertions in it is still teaching at one of the premier law schools of the country.
You know, it's interesting to me, of course, you know, this memo is one in a stream that have come out of the Department of Justice since 9/11. There's the famous what's called the torture memo, which is August 1st, 2002, in which many of the same arguments before this recent release, many of the same arguments are made. This one goes a little farther, particularly on the maiming statute, which was not covered in the earlier one. The earlier one covered both the Geneva Conventions and the anti-torture statute, war crime statute, but didn't cover maiming. So I guess they still thought they had some openings and they may have wanted to maim some more people. And Yoo has been teaching there for a long time. I've actually spoken at Berkeley. In fact, one of our lawyers is out there last week, and it's Gita, who does all our work on torture and Guantanamo is out there, and this guy teaches there, and there's always protests there and everything. So it's been a long time, and what's interesting to me is that there's been so little reaction again. I mean, the Guild was out there out front on this, but so little reaction again to seeing another torture memo. It's one of the saddest commentaries on the state of our country right now.
I was just going to contrast that to what happened to Norman Finkelstein. Here, Yoo gets a job at the University of California, prestigious job. Finkelstein, who's working at a middle-level college in Chicago, writes a book about the misuse of the Holocaust, stands up for the rights of Palestinians. He loses his job. So Yoo gets promoted for writing a torture memo. Finkelstein tells the truth, and he loses his job. That's where things are in academia these years.
I think that's a really good point, Michael. The fact that we are basically hiring war criminals at our major universities is a real shock. It's a real shock. But, you know, maybe it makes some sense. I mean, the administration is essentially a group of war criminals right now. It follows the course. I mean, it used to be from the administration into, like, some big corporation. Now it's from, being a war criminal and going into teaching war criminals.
There's a great play at the Joseph Papp Theater on Lafayette Street in Manhattan called the Paris Commune that I want to recommend to all our New York listeners. The Paris Commune...
Isn't that a restaurant on Bleecker Street?
It's also that. No, I think they moved.
They moved.
But the Paris Commune historically was this uprising of the citizens of Paris in 1871. They took power and they instituted kind of a libertarian socialism for 75 days until the French army, which was camped outside of Paris, marched in and slaughtered 35,000 people. But it was the great example of people taking power into their own hands and passing laws that are humane. The Paris Commune was like the great beginning of the modern libertarian socialist movement. And the play captures that perfectly. It's a beautiful play, a lot of good songs in it, terrific acting. The Paris Commune, I recommend people go check it out.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we hear excerpts from the event titled An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. That's the title of the memoirs recently released by Murat Kurnaz, who was detained at Guantanamo for 5 years. Kurnaz is a Turkish citizen and a legal resident of Germany. He traveled to Pakistan to learn more about his Muslim faith and was later arrested at a checkpoint, handed to the United States, and eventually taken to Guantanamo. The event gathered together a panel of attorneys from the United States and Germany who fought for Murat's release, and a Guantanamo chaplain who was accused of espionage and then imprisoned. The speakers include Bahir Azmi, Bernard Dock, Philippe Sands, actor Wallace Shawn, and military chaplain James Yee. The panel was moderated by our own Michael Ratner. Let's have a listen.
From Bremen, Germany, to Peshawar, Pakistan. I had announced to my parents that I wanted to get married and start a family. I was old enough to look for a Muslim woman who adhered to the rules of Islam. But before I could do that, I had to change my life. I had to become pious and live according to Allah's rules. I had had enough of discos and of Turks who used and dealt drugs and got sent to prison, and I was sick of my job as a bouncer. Eventually, I gave up the life I'd been leading. The people I knew, even if they'd been friends, had started ripping each other off. All anyone was interested in anymore was money, so that they could buy the latest stuff, cell phones, Game Boys, and laptops, and they didn't care where they got that money. My whole family drove to Turkey. My aunt arranged a meeting with Fatima. I was already sure after our first meeting that Fatima was the right one for me. In the end, Fatima's father said, if our children would like to marry, let it bring them happiness. Then he asked Fatima, and she said yes. The wedding ceremony took place in my aunt's yard. Hundreds of people came. We exchanged rings bound together with a red ribbon. We were happy. Fatima and I had agreed that she would stay with her parents until I had taken care of the formalities in Bremen so that she could emigrate to Germany. That was supposed to be around Christmas. I started to worry. I was now married, but what did I know about our faith? I had prayed in a few mosques, but the mosques didn't teach us much about Islam. I hardly knew anything about the Quran, about how it had been written and how it was meant to be read. I knew very little about the prophets and the laws and the commandments. How was a pious husband supposed to behave? What were my responsibilities? I hadn't even really learned to pray properly. I had thought about going to Pakistan and studying at the Mansoura Center for some time. Now my mind was finally made up. I could go there and be back by Christmas. If I had told my mother that I intended to travel to Pakistan, she wouldn't have let me go. Even though I was 19 years old, she would have forbidden me to get on the plane. The problem was how to say goodbye to her without making it look like that was what I was doing. I decided to tell her my back was hurting and ask her for a massage. I could hug her in thanks afterward. That would be my goodbye. I went upstairs saying, Anna, my back hurts. Can you give me a massage? It's very late, my mother said. I'll give you one tomorrow. I stood on the stairs. My mother was in her bedroom. I couldn't see her in the darkness. Salaam alaikum, I said. Alaikum salam, she answered. I wouldn't see my mother again until I was 25. When I arrived in Karachi on October 3 in my wool sweater and overcoat, I discovered that autumn in Pakistan was as warm as summer in Bremen. Every day we studied the Quran. We were taught to read and interpret the Quran and how to pray. We learned how we could help other people. We would sleep in one mosque and then spend the next day in other mosques. On the day I was set to leave Pakistan, the bus we took to the airport was painted in bright colors. There were little bells and strings of red and yellow blinking party lights. It looked like a disco. We came to a checkpoint. The little bells in the bus jingled as the bus came to a halt. The policeman got up from his chair and peered through the window. He knocked on the window and said something to me in Urdu. He asked me for my papers, at least I think he did. I handed them over. Then he motioned for me to get out of the bus. I was told to go inside the police station.
Thank you, Wally. I'm Michael Ratner, and I'm the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. And we were the organization that first began representing Guantanamo detainees in 2002. We continue coordinating all of the Guantanamo cases today and are now for the third time in the Supreme Court trying to get any kind of rights for the people at Guantanamo, the right to be free from torture, the right to go to court. I'm here really today to introduce the panel and then have a discussion. As you know, that was Wally Shawn reading, one of my favorites, Obie Award-winning playwright, actor, author as well as actor in My Dinner with Andre, and of course, my daughter's favorite actor, because she comes home one day and says, "Daddy, Daddy, there's someone in this movie, Princess Bride, who looks just like you." I said, "Who's that?" Well, later she saw Wally at another thing. He says, "That's the man, that's the man." And it turns out it was Wally Shawn. So Wally and I have since then become good acquaintances on our way to being good friends. Next to Wally is Bahar Azmi. Bahar is a professor of law at Seton Hall Law School. In July 2004, after we won the first case in the Supreme Court giving some rights to detainees, he began the representation of Murat Kurnaz, who was imprisoned in Guantanamo until August of 2006 and had been visiting Guantanamo and Murat since that time. To his right is another friend of mine through this litigation, Bernard Docke. He's a German lawyer from Bremen, started representing Murat Kurnaz in 2002, never actually got to see Murat Kurnaz until Murat stepped off the plane in Bremen, or wherever he stepped off, I think Bernard will tell us. And where?
Darmstadt.
And didn't see his client for all of those years. Next to Bernard is Philippe Sands. Philippe may be well known to you from a recent article he has in Vogue called The Green Light, which is the green light to torture, the green light to torture by Donald Rumsfeld. He also has a new book coming out called Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. Next to him is Chaplain James Yee. I've known Chaplain James Yee for a long time. He was, if you recall, he was the chaplain, the only really full-time Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo for 10 months until one day I read in the paper, espionage, espionage, espionage. And of course, it turned out to be a completely fallacious and fake case. James has also written a book, very good book, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. So there's a lot of good books here, and particularly this one, which I know, I see Alessandra sitting there. She'll kill me if I don't talk about it, but I would talk about it anyway. It's 5 years of my life, an innocent man in Guantanamo, and it doesn't have just a great cover. You can actually not put the book down. It's that good, and it's unrelenting. I've been working with the people at Guantanamo for many years, and when you read this story, it still will come to you as an utter and complete shock. So with that, we'll now begin the panel, and I'm going to just stay from here. My first question, really, is to Bahar. Where is Murat Kurnaz? Why isn't he with us today?
It's a good question. Now he's visiting his ailing mother in Turkey, who a place he hasn't been able to visit since his wedding in the summer of 2001, which was about 5 months before he was taken into detention by the United States, and 7 years. And that's not to say that he doesn't want to be here. He would love to come here to this event and to the United States in general, but he can't. He's been designated an enemy combatant by the U.S. government, and that's not a legal term. It really has no precedent, at least as defined by the military, in U.S. or international law. It's a term created by the U.S. military and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. Hopefully talk a little bit later about the breadth of that term. It is, I think, absurd enough to make Kafka blush. And he was designated enemy combatant not by a judge. No detaining Guantanamo has ever been before a federal judge. And this is even 3.5 years after the Supreme Court ordered that process to begin. He was designated enemy combatant by this ad hoc military tribunal made up of three non-lawyer military personnel without the benefit of a lawyer, and unable, like all the detainees who went through this absurd process, unable to see the evidence that formed the basis of the enemy combatant designation. As incredibly easy as it is to be designated an enemy combatant, it's impossible to shake that designation. Once you're an enemy combatant, at least according to the military, you're always an enemy combatant. And that's in part because there's absolutely no legal process to test this determination. It is by fiat, by military judgment. And just to give us sort of a couple of examples of what that designation implies, in addition to an obvious prohibition on entering the United States, when he was flown out of Guantanamo to released in Germany, although the U.S. government has never said he was released to Germany, he was transferred to Germany because release would imply an entitlement to release. He was flown in an enormous C-17 military transport plane with between 10 and 15 U.S. military personnel, fully hooded, goggled, with eardrums, and shackled his hands together to his feet, and sedated, and was taken out of the plane just as he had entered the plane to Guantanamo. Another example is, I think a journalist asked the commanding officer, Admiral Harry Harris, in Guantanamo after he was released and after all of this evidence of his innocence had come to light, what do you think about the release of Murat Kurnaz, about all the evidence of his innocence? And his response is, he's an enemy combatant. They're all enemy combatants. Mm-hmm.
Bernard, Wally referred at the end about the manner in which Murat was picked up and taken off a bus. I'd like a little more detail about that, and then some sort of overview of the beginning and the end of Murat's case.
Yeah, in short terms, Murat Kurnaz left Bremen to Karachi on October 301, and he pilgrimed in Pakistan, or tried to pilgrim. They didn't accept him at a Muslim school. It was obviously the worst possible time to pilgrim at in Pakistan at that time, but he was obviously kind of naive and had no idea about the political surroundings. So at that time he has been in Pakistan, and 2 months later, or six weeks later, he got arrested by Pakistani police out of the bus without any cause. He just looked different. They picked him out. A few days later, they sold him to U.S. forces in, I think, $3,000.
Right. And he had on him a return ticket, which is where he was going back to...
Yeah, and gifts for his family. No weapons, but gifts for his family and a return ticket. Yeah.
Give us some overview of, like, the beginning of the arrest and the end, and just how many years, and then, when you started representing him.
He was put in the camp in Kandahar, and 6 weeks later he was transferred, probably in February 02, to Guantanamo, and he had to stay in Guantanamo up to August 06, right. Yeah, I came in contact with that case by his mother. She came in my office in Bremen in May 02. I heard about that case out of the media. But the mother thought, okay, I hire a lawyer and my son will be back soon. But it was not that easy, I can tell you. The most Orwellian experience I ever had to work as a lawyer in a law-free zone. All my skills, all my experience hit the wall. All legal means you can start with if someone is detained, they were denied. All legal means which ought to be self-evident for a state which is based on the rule of law were denied. So we had no file, we had no warrant of arrest, we had no charge, we had no judge, no legal proceeding, just nothing. And he was kept incommunicado. I had no chance to get in contact to him. We had no idea where, when, and why he got arrested and how long he had to stay. because I was blocked with my legal means, I had to work in the court of public opinion and to get in contact with the media and to try to convince the German and Turkish government to take diplomatic pressure on the US. And this situation has changed when we got in contact with US human rights organizations, the ACLU, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and especially the CCR. And we were part of the proceedings to convince US courts that even the detainees in Guantanamo are human beings and have the right for a day in the court in the US. And after the landmark decision of the Supreme Court, Bahar Azmi was boarded for that case, and he made incredible good work for that case. And okay, he was not released by court order, but I think the legal fights were very helpful, first to get in contact to Murat, to break through the incommunicado system, second to get the file and to get an idea about that silly allegations. And when we had contact with him and could tell the public about the torture and the silly allegations, I think it was a shift in the public opinion about this kind of case. So even if it took very long, and even there was not a court decision to release him, and you can say justice delayed is justice denied, it was not in vain. It helped a lot. And thanks again for the CCR and other organizations. And Murat is not here personally, but I can tell you he's very, very thankful to you.
Thank you. And you know, one thing that comes up when you read the book, as Bernard referred to, he's 19 years old, Murat. It's 3 months after 9/11. And he's going to study being a better Muslim in Pakistan. And you say, well, does this make any sense? And I've interviewed a bunch of the clients that we've had at the center and saying, this just doesn't sound right to me, but slowly it comes around to me. And I think, Wally, you had a reaction to reading that part in the book also of some sort.
Yes, when I first started reading it, I thought, how believable is this? Because why is he going over there, and why didn't he tell his mother? I don't know, by the time I'd read a certain amount of the book, I was totally convinced that the man is totally on the level, and I believed everything that he said. But to us, it seems surprising that why couldn't he study Islam in the library in Bremen?
This is where I want to hear from Chaplain James Yee. As you recall, James Yee was the chaplain at Guantanamo for 10 months until it went from espionage to something else till they finally got an honorable discharge. Chaplain Yee, I know you were actually there at the time that Murat was there, so I think there's two issues that maybe to address. Is one is, how believable is the story, and I'm sure a lot of Americans think, well, people, all the Muslims, they just go there to fight Americans. And is there another reason? And then, if you had any interaction with Murat when you were at Guantanamo?
Yeah, I'll say that from the perspective of an American Muslim convert like myself, his decision to go overseas and study the Quran seriously, study the religion traditionally, is 100% believable. I myself did that very same thing after I converted to Islam while I was in the military, and actually recognizing that there weren't any Muslim chaplains in the ranks of our military. Did the same exact thing. I left active duty, and then I went overseas. I actually went to Damascus, Syria, which is another of the world's learning centers of Islam, to study the Quran, to learn how to read the Quran properly in its proper classical Arabic, to learn Islam under traditional Muslim scholars. And then I would return to the United States, taking what I learned, taking the curriculum that I was exposed to, one that was really founded and encouraged an open dialogue with people of other faiths, and return to the ranks of the military as a Muslim chaplain to promote religious diversity, to promote religious freedom within our military, and to contribute further in making the United States a better country. I think what's really interesting is Murat was doing just that. He wanted to become a better person. He went overseas to learn the Quran, to instill in himself the values that the Quran teaches. Values which really, from my study, mirror the values of our own country right here in the United States and in the Constitution. I think it's a shame that what happened to Murat is when he was put in Guantanamo and in the Afghani prison, in a sense, the U.S. government, which did this to him, stopped him from coming back to Germany and sharing the values that Islam advocates, values that actually, when you study Islam, mirror values of the Western society, values like diversity, religious freedom, justice, equality. I think Murad had a great opportunity to make a special contribution to Germany in coming back, but before he was able to get on that return flight, instead he landed in Guantanamo.
Well, thank you. And Philippe Sands. Philippe Sands, I didn't mention, is also the author of a book called Lawless World. And that there's two sort of books here. Lawless World is really about post 9/11, in my view, in general, and then a new one is about torture. But I'd like Philippe to put it into some context in terms of what are we really looking at here when we're picking up enemy combatants around the world, holding them without trials, Guantanamos, Bagrams.
Well, Murat Kunaz arrived in Guantanamo at a very crucial moment. In February 2002, President Bush took a decision on the 7th of February, and he decided by executive order that none of the detainees at Guantanamo, whether they were Taliban or Al-Qaeda or anything else, would have any rights under the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions, as many of you know, were adopted in 1949, and they were adopted largely at the instance of the United States, which played a very strong role in putting forward a program which essentially said, under both Roosevelt and Truman, after the horrors of the Second World War, we would move to an international order which was based on the rule of law. It was sort of an exportation of American legal and constitutional values. And the 49 Geneva Conventions had a core provision, all four of them, called Common Article 3, which basically says there are certain minimum standards that are applicable to all persons at all times in all circumstances. And with a sweep of the pen, on the 7th of February 2002, President Bush got rid of that, and he got rid of Common Article 3. The book that you described, the second book, Torture Team, which is also edited by Alessandra, who I'm delighted is here, is the story of how that decision was taken. And in short, the way the administration presents the narrative is that they were just following the law. They just looked at the conventions and determined, on the facts as they were, that there had been a paradigm shift and that nobody, amazingly, at Guantanamo had any rights under Geneva. Now, this struck me as counterintuitive. This is a nation of laws, you know that. The lawyering in the military, the lawyering at the Department of Justice is of the highest quality. It's unparalleled. There's no place in the world where it's done better. And we all knew that Common Article 3 was Common Article 3, so something happened. And I describe in the piece, and much more detail in the book, how I got to the truth about what happened. And it happened large part at the instance of a man called Douglas Feith, who was in charge of policy under Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz at the Department of Defense. I went on a journey around America. I identified him as a central player. I contacted him. He graciously agreed to meet me. I went to see him at his office at Georgetown. He'd left government. I was told by him he worked on the 8th floor, got into the building. The elevator only went up to the 7th floor. They'd parked Doug Feith somewhere that was apparently unreachable. When I did reach him, and when he had stopped talking about himself, I was able to discover what had happened. And in a moment of amazing illumination, he confessed that the decision was taken to remove all constraints on treatment of detainees.
Thank you. We still have approximately 275 people in Guantanamo. The U.S. is still planning serious death penalty prosecutions against a number of them.
That was an excerpt from the event titled An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life.
Amen.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.